Good evening. You're listening to WNUR 89.3 FM HD1 Evanston, Chicago. I'm Juliet, and this is WNUR News at 6. Tonight, a look at the line between fame and fan fiction. The rise of the new film Drop. Did this year's March Madness miss the mark? And all you need to know about Coachella Weekend 1. These stories and more coming up from Northwestern University. This is WNUR News at 6. Adaptations of classic literature are famous, from Paradise Lost to 10 Things I Hate About You. But when does an adaptation of a famous work become fan fiction? And can iconic fan fiction, like 50 Shades of Grey, be counted as part of the pantheon? Mika Ellison has the story.
It's London, in 1988. At the Old Vic Theatre, director Jonathan Miller is staging a production of Shakespeare's The Tempest. The Old Vic is no stranger to Shakespeare. Something's a little different about this one. Instead of submitting to Prospero's words as he leaves his enchanted island, Ariel, his magical servant, retrieves his destroyed staff and puts it together again, raising it above his head. A play about colonial rule is now about the transfer of political power in a post-colonial society. Fast forward to 2011, when writer E.L. James's self-published erotic novel, 50 Shades of Grey, becomes a worldwide bestseller. It was also famously Twilight fanfiction. So what do 50 Shades of Grey and a production of a Shakespeare play have in common?
I'm Jen Comerford. I'm currently a visiting assistant professor in the English department at Northwestern. This quarter, I'm teaching a class called Fans and Fiction, Adaptation as Critique in Literature and Film.
Professor Comerford considered both of them when she was putting together her class syllabus.
My class is largely about, as the title suggests, how adaptation is a different mode of critique. And so part of this is thinking about like how we can kind of expand or put pressure on the kind of traditional ideas of what the literary canon is.
Using canonical texts like Austen and Shakespeare, Professor Comerford's class explores the limits and possibilities of adaptation. And, as its name suggests, it also asks if fan fiction, or fan-made stories about characters from books like Twilight and The Hunger Games, count as part of the legacy of adaptation. And although they're not exactly the same, Professor Comerford pointed out that there's certainly a lot of overlap between fanfiction and adaptation and why they come to exist.
You know, adaptation or fanfiction or things like that are indicators that these texts aren't, you know, there are things in these texts that aren't giving everything that people need or want.
To get the student perspective, I sat down with two Northwestern students who have read and written fanfiction. Here's Abigail Jacob on why and how she first found fanfiction.
I don't know if you know The Legend Trilogy by Marie Lu. I was really into that when I was in middle school. And spoiler for anyone who hasn't read it, it has a very bittersweet ending. And that like emotionally wrecked me at 2 a.m. in my bed. So it's like, okay, there needs to be a different ending. So I go online and I search up like, you know, book name, alternate ending. And I find this magical site called fanfiction.net. And that was the beginning of everything.
Sometimes fanfiction happens because readers want to explore new possibilities. But other times, it's because they want to critique or explore nuances that weren't present in the original work.
There's this adaptation of Pride and Prejudice that we're going to be reading part of called Longbourn, which is told from the perspective of the servants in the household. So, I mean, already, you know, there's a lot of criticism about, you know, the way Austen kind of attends to a very narrow range of like social classes, right? So like the servants don't really pop up that much. And so it's interesting from that standpoint already to be paying attention to, okay, what are the servants doing? And that changes, for instance, the way that I then look at Pride and Prejudice, because I'm a little bit more attuned to pay attention for the moments when the servants do pop up.
Like Professor Comerford, NU student Asha Mehta has a piece of fan-made fiction that felt significant for how it interacted with the source material. This one is about the recently rebooted television show She-Ra, specifically the romantic relationship between the characters Catra and Adora.
There's this story called Don't Go. It's about 5,000 words, and it's sort of this, like, episode 9.5 of season 5 of She-Ra. Basically, you know, Catra and Adora, they're like a lesbian relationship that wasn't able to be like fully realized in the show. It's not smut, it's just like a romantic fanfic about like them getting closer and sort of processing everything they've been through. And it wasn't, you know, probably allowed to actually be included in the show. So whether or not Andy Stevenson, the showrunner, is the one who wrote that, I think, either way, it was a really beautiful piece of fanfic.
Abigail Jacob had a similar experience with a Sarah J. Maas book.
So I read Throne of Glass in middle school, and, like, it was, like, both, like, my thing, but also not my thing. I had, like, a lot of problems with it. I think a lot of people liked Throne of Glass, and it was hard to find people who, like, had my same opinions. Like, this could be improved, and this could be improved. So then I find, like, this fan fiction online basically pointing out all, like, the moral dilemmas and, like, plot issues and stuff that I had issues with, and they were, like, rewriting it to, like, actually, like, talk about, like, the issues of slavery and, like, multiracial identity and stuff like that. And I was, like, you know, like, it was, like, the instance where fanfiction is doing it better than the actual book, in my opinion.
Fanfiction is often considered adaptation's weird younger sibling. It's unregulated, not traditionally published, and, to be honest, varies a lot more in quality. But I asked Professor Comerford about why she thinks it's still worth it to give fanfiction its flowers. Here's her answer.
I think that one of the things I feel like that doesn't get given a lot of credit in literary studies is this, like, idea of, like, enjoyment or pleasure in reading. Like, that's kind of besides the point. Everyone kind of assumes, sure, if you're here, you probably like to read. But, like, whether or not you enjoyed the text is not the kind of main question. And I think fan fiction, maybe this is part of why it gets slightly denigrated in some ways, is because it kind of leans into this question of, like, how can we enjoy what we're reading, or, like, make it speak to us in a different way. And that I think there's a lot of value in that we don't necessarily always give credit to.
So fan fiction and adaptation share a lineage, although they start from and are sometimes bound by source texts. They provide the opportunity for a piece of literature to become something more than what it was. They're a chance for readers to not only listen to a piece of writing, but to speak back to it. The source text is the start of the conversation, and not the end. Also, in case you were wondering, stage productions aren't the only adaptations of Shakespeare out there.
I just remembered that I did read Shakespeare fanfiction at one point.
For WNUR News, I'm Mika Ellison.
Northwestern students got an early adrenaline rush this past week for an exclusive pre-screening of Drop. Kara Totley has the story.
On April 9th, Northwestern students were able to attend an exclusive screening of Universal Pictures' new movie, Drop.
We hope you enjoy. We'll get it started. Woo!
Drop follows Violet, played by Megan Fahey, a widowed mother whose night out turns into a nightmare when a mysterious stranger threatens to kill her son unless she murders her date.
When I find out who's threatening my son, I'll show them how dangerous a mother can be.
School of Communication senior Jefferson Snedker took charge of organizing the event.
I applied and got the NBC Universal campus brand ambassador position last year in the springtime. A few months ago, I got an email from my boss saying, we're going to be pre-screening Drop. And we figured out a date and they sent me some merch. We got in contact with the theater and it happened. It was a lot of fun.
But the biggest priority was getting the word out.
I needed to get butts in seats on April 9th in our specific theater. So that was a lot more postering. That was a lot more physical marketing, talking to people individually. I printed out a bunch of invitations and hand sealed them in envelopes and wrote on them and gave them to every single student in CRC.
The posters worked as they caught the attention of Weinberg freshman Addison Brookins.
I saw a flyer this morning on the wall at Kresge when I was at one of my classes. So I was like, oh, it's a free movie. That sounds fun. I've been wanting to see a movie, but there hasn't been anything good. And I've seen a lot of trailers for this movie, so I thought it would be fun to come and see it.
For Medill Jr. Amanda Oliver, the free screening was a plus, but it was the atmosphere that made it memorable.
I really enjoyed it. I think part of it is that I love going to movies with a bunch of Northwestern people because I think the theater interactions and vibes, like, really play into the movie.
More than 140 Northwestern students RSVP'd, packing the 120-seat theater with students who weren't shy about laughing, cheering, and reacting out loud. Though Drop at its core is a digital tech thriller, it blended so many other elements and subgenres that even the organizer was surprised.
I went into this movie a little bit pessimistic. Wasn't sure how they were going to handle this kind of intense thriller tone with these goofy airdrops. But upon seeing the film, I was thoroughly entertained. I thought that The airdrops added a layer of like fun to this, but they didn't focus on it too much that it took away from this serious tone and these stakes.
A sentiment shared by others in the audience.
I thought it was really funny. I wasn't expecting it to be as funny as it was. Like all throughout it, there's really funny like phone memes that happen and just really funny character interaction. And then again, with Northwestern students, it's just the humor's amplified. So the whole movie was just a silly, goofy time.
I liked the pacing of it and I liked the action sequences and it was different than I expected. Really good.
It might not be a classic horror film, but Drop still landed well with viewers, backed up by its 83% certified fresh score on Rotten Tomatoes. For those who missed the pre-screening of Drop, the thriller hit theaters on Friday, April 11th, and Snedker says more exclusive screenings could be on the way for Northwestern.
I had a conversation with my boss after our pre-screening, and we do not have a date just yet, but stay tuned for a free pre-screening at the AMC theaters of the new live-action How to Train Your Dragon.
For WNUR News, I'm Cara Totley.
March Madness this year lacks some factors that fans love. But what is the sense on Northwestern's campus? Gabe Shumway has more.
In many cases, this year's men's March Madness tournament made headlines for all the wrong reasons. 2025 was the first year since 2008 where every number one seed made the Final Four. 2008 was also the last time that no seed below a 12 won their first round matchup. Fans called for more interesting games. Some even touted the tournament as the most boring March Madness of all time. Northwestern is a place full of sports fans and sports writers, so I caught up with three who all disagreed with the idea that this was the most boring March Madness ever.
If there was ever going to be a year that all four of the one seeds made it, it was going to be this year. But I also think at the same time, that made for a really exciting Final Four.
That's Medill junior Patrick Winograd. During this college basketball season, Winograd hosted Bracket Babel, a college basketball podcast. He pointed to the thin margins of the Final Four and national championship games as factors that made for a good tournament, despite the lack of upsets.
There weren't any upsets in the early rounds, and I think that's something that kind of defines March Madness, is that it's the madness aspect of it, right? It's a 16 beating a 1, it's UMBC. It's Fairleigh Dickinson, it's all that stuff, but, you know, maybe we've gotten a little bit spoiled.
While the upsets are always a major appeal of March Madness, there are factors beyond this that fans find important. For Medill sophomore Eliav Brooks-Rubin, who writes the column Collins Classroom, analyzing Northwestern basketball, the coaching was a sight to behold.
Kelvin Sampson against Duke, the way he defended in the second half, was remarkable. I think everything Florida does in the second half of basketball games has really impressed me. They changed up their looks defensively. They got out on the break more, and then offensively, some of the sets that Florida runs, I was just blown away by.
While many agree that this was not the most boring March Madness, other critics fear that the transfer portal might mean this question will be asked more in the future. With mid-major players and coaches consistently being scooped by top programs in need, the gap has become wider and wider between a national champion like Florida and a strong mid-major program. Medill first-year Charlie Jacobs noted this as a pattern of things to come, especially if schools have more funding to use toward NIL contracts for players.
Upsets weren't as existent this year, but also it makes sense with how college basketball and just college sports in general have really transitioned to these power conferences, really showing their power, really showing how impressive these players are because they come from all these smaller programs through the transfer portal. Coaches leave, they go to bigger schools, and all their players follow them.
As revenue sharing between sports begins to play a role in the world of college athletics, schools with larger football programs may have more money to go around. For some powerhouse football schools, this may mean more money to attract basketball recruits as well. For fans who love a dramatic upset, not all hope is lost. Winograd pointed to other divisions of college athletics as having some incredible athletes. In particular, Drake's coach, Ben McCollum, who took the job at Drake after coaching at Division II Northwest Missouri State. With McCollum came a smorgasbord of elite D2 talent.
It's just going to be about what coaches at the mid-major level can kind of identify those players in D2, in JUCO, that they can bring up to replace the guys that inevitably do get poached by the bigger teams with more NIL money, bigger programs.
For WNUR News, I'm Gabe Shumway.
Spring has sprung, which can only mean two things. The B-List and Coachella are both back. Basil Free gets you up to date on what happened at the musical festival this past weekend.
Welcome to the B-List, your weekly roundup of celebrity mess and pop culture. This week, a much-needed recap of the first weekend of this year's Coachella Valley Music and Arts Festival. Coachella welcomed music fans into the blazing desert sun this past weekend, delivering a packed weekend of major musical moments and a few faux pas. Known for drawing huge crowds decked out in the hottest boho chic attire, Coachella has become a major entity in American pop culture, which is why we, at the B-List, are here to keep you informed about all of this year's happenings in Indio. Starting first with Friday, Tyla made her Coachella debut this year, cooling off the desert with a set capped off with a performance of her hit Water. Other performances throughout the day included up-and-comer Glorilla, longtime legend Missy Elliott, and Lisa of Blackpink fame, who made reference to her character in The White Lotus during her fiery set. Benson Boone wowed the stage with a bombastic cover of Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody, bringing out founding member Brian May to play alongside him. The end of the night saw an epic headlining performance by pop legend Lady Gaga, who brought theatrics to the desert to celebrate her newest album Mayhem. Moving into Saturday, legendary bands Weezer and Green Day proved that rock is as alive as ever, with both delivering a flurry of their greatest hits. Charli XCX proved that Brat Summer continues on in her electrifying Golden Hour set, bringing out stars like Troye Sivan, Lorde, and Billie Eilish to complement her punchy performance. Other major highlights included an energized set from rapper Travis Scott and indie singer Claro, bringing out U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders to deliver a political message. Into the last day, Sunday featured a headlining performance by rapper-turned-country star Post Malone, who offered a celebratory set on a stage converted into a Formula One racetrack. Rapper Megan Thee Stallion powered through her set despite a handful of technical issues, while Blackpink's Jennie made her solo debut in the desert. Other notable moments include Addison Rae's cameo in Arca's set, a low-key main stage bout by Biba Doobie, and a Coachella Country Hour debut by Shaboozey. Through all of the Instagrammable content, to some, Coachella wasn't as perfect as it made to seem this year. This year's festival has drawn comparisons to the doomed 2017 Fyre Festival, with some reporting waiting in 12-hour lines with no access to bathrooms or food to enter the campgrounds. Other reports include long waits for the on-site showers and problems with lockers. That's all for the B-List this week. Check in next Monday to hear about what happens this week in pop culture. For WNUR News, I'm Basil Free.
Now for a brief look at the forecast. Did anyone else fall for Fool's Spring? The first couple weeks of spring quarter had us all retreating back to our coats. Today, we finally saw some sun, but it came with some pretty serious wind. And while the sun will stick around, Tuesday and Wednesday temps will drop into the high 40s and low 50s. Then, expect some spurts of rain on Thursday, along with some strong winds. We may even see some hail on Friday. Taking a look into headlines in Evanston, Chicagoland, and across the nation and globe. Early this morning, Northwestern police responded to reports of anti-Semitic vandalism outside University Hall and Kresge Hall. President Schill sent out a statement regarding the incident this afternoon. On another note, Northwestern heard the roaring of prospective new Wildcats today as admitted students explored campus for Wildcat Day. This was the second and final Wildcat Day of the year. Also this morning, Katy Perry went extraterrestrial. That's right, Blue Origin's all-female crew completed their trip into space. The flight lasted around 11 minutes and traveled more than 60 miles above Earth. That's all for WNUR News at 6 p.m. For more news updates and reports, follow us on X at WNUR News and Instagram at WNUR News 89.3. You can listen to these and other WNUR News stories on our website, WNURnews.org. That's WNURnews.org. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Our producer today is Sophia Quesa, and our reporters are Mika Ellison, Cara Totley, Gabe Shumway, and Basil Free. I'm Juliet Allen. Catch our next newscast Wednesday, April 16th. Now, back to scheduled programming.